Welcome to Paint on Politics, a podcast where host Dr. Gregory Payne of Emerson College sits down with fellow experts to discuss the current state of politics, public opinion, and global affairs. In a world growing increasingly complex, communication and critical thinking is key. This only makes the Emerson motto, expression necessary to evolution, more true.
Hello, I'm Gregory Payne, the Chair of Communication Studies, the first communication department in the United States, and also co-director of the Emerson Blanquerna Global Center. I'm here with someone who really was the gateway for me to come to Emerson. So for all of you who are happy Payne is at doing politics at Emerson, you can say thank you, or thank you, as Helen Rose would say. And for those who are not, I would say you can blame Vito Silvestri, because he was the one who said, gee, you should come to Emerson. And I said, tell me why. All I would say is you never should doubt an Indiana Hoosier. Vito, welcome to Paint on Politics.
I almost missed you at the airport. Someone said he's a redheaded guy, and that's how I found you.
Yes. Well, I was found, and here I am. Vito, you are, when you say Emerson College, and we talk about the legacy campus, here's 21 Commonwealth. I think, first of all, you were the chair when I was there. How long have you been at Emerson?
My God. Since 1964, I was a student here in 57, 58.
Yes, yes. What was your major? When you were a student.
Oh, at Emerson?
Yes.
I came to study oral and terp, and I did a minor, and I picked up some courses in speech therapy just to enhance the speech therapy work I had done before. But I was a general speech major as an undergrad and
right.
an English minor.
So you had June Mitchell. We just talked about
Conte. Yeah, June was great.
Yes. So can you give us a little bit about what you remember about June, or as people say, who knew her and loved her, Mama Mitchell.
She was proud of being called Mama because she didn't have kids. But June was the finest of all of the so-called big three. June was the best of the interpreters. And I say that because she had more range. Every 3 or 4 years she would do Romeo and Juliet, which is, it's an incredible thing. She was a tall Nordic woman, beautiful, high cheekbones and all of that. She was good with me when I first came. She was open to what students could offer, and then she'd encourage some of the stuff that you did that was, so that you wouldn't embarrass yourself.
Yes, yes, yes.
But that's one of the things I liked about her, a general sense of tolerance, maybe it was what I needed at the time, but... I was kind of resistant because I was brought up as an undergrad in a more conservative approach to interpretation of literature, where the emphasis is not on you as a performer so much as you as an interpreter, a vehicle for the literature itself, and you usually had the text in front of you. If you memorize, then you were asking people aesthetically to accept your performance rather than to engage their imagination together so that they could bring what they want to it, and you gave enough stimulus and suggestion of character or meaning so that there was another thing that happened between the interpreter, the literature, and the audience. So there was, so I sort of battled that when I was here. But they said, well, you have to do something where you, and you have to do a play or something. And so I think I did All Wilderness, and I worked on that. And Bender was good.
Was Coleman Bender,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, Coleman Bender. And it's sad that there's no memorial to him. He was a tough guy, but he held the school together. Mm-hmm. He was head of the master's program, he had the speech department, and he was really strongly educated, and he nurtured Phil Amato, John Zacharias, and and me.
Yes.
You know, which I think was pretty good. But June was she would make suggestions. She would ask you to try things. You always felt as if she was working with you.
Yes.
And in class, one of the things that she did as a teacher was, I think the first thing, she got kids to accept her as her. And she would, once in a while, to illustrate a point, she would, in an interp class, she would do a scene from something. I'll never forget the day that she had seven characters. It was the play about the Barrymores. I don't know if it was called that. It's not They Knew What They Wanted, but it was something else, I think. Anyway, seven characters come in and out, and it's on the Barrymore family.
She's doing seven characters.
Right. And they're coming in and out of this room.
Yes.
And she said that, and she was presenting it as a problem, but it was astounding.
Right.
Just
right.
Astounding. And when she retired, the college tried to make up for the. I remember that I got a job offer at the State College in Potsdam, New York, and it was for 5570, and she had heard that I got this job offer, and I didn't know where the heck it was. we ended up guarding the Canadian border up there, but 15 miles from Canada. At any rate, she said, "That's interesting." She said, "I make $5,000 a year." And this was 1958. Mm-hmm. I had been offered a job as when I finished my undergrad work for speech therapy in Norristown, Pennsylvania, and I was to be the therapist for the entire school system. And all I could think of was I'd go from one place to another and have curriculum files from kindergarten on up through to seniors, and you know. And I just couldn't see myself doing that.
So you went from Emerson then to Bloomington, to Indiana, correct, to get your PhD?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You had, of course, rhetorical icon Gunderson.
Had Gunderson, God love him.
Yes.
And
then you came back.
Jeffrey Auer.
Right. But both.
Raymond Smith was the experimental guy.
I remember Jeffrey Auer. I was at Illinois at the time. Now, Coleman Bender was an Illini, so I
he
think we've got that Big
Illinois,
Ten.
Yeah.
Now, when you came back, you were teaching. Who was the chair at the time when you came back? Because when I got here, you were the chair. You've been the chair for a while.
Bender was chair.
Bender was chair.
Yeah.
Right. And so you came, when did you
become? That's right.
Yeah. When did you become chair? Was it the 80s?
I don't know.
Yes.
I was chair for 9 years.
Right.
And I was glad to get into the classroom again.
Right, right.
What year did you come?
I came 84, that area. I think it might have been Bender. I think you'd been chair for a bit because I remember it was you, Walt, it was Fran Lasciotto, Ted Hollingworth,
right.
Fran, or
right.
Let's see, Bernie, who just passed away. We saw that.
Yeah.
Vito, when you think of Emerson then as well as now, I mean, you describe it where Mama Mitchell, it was very immersive, very engaged with students. You've taught here. Do you think it's the same now? I mean, how has Emerson changed over the years?
Oh, it's not the same at all.
Yeah.
The most fundamental thing was gone, and that was the speech work with the students.
Yes.
The students don't get the refinement as personal communicators.
Right.
They should get. And when I came back to teach, Emerson, Bender had engineered the trustees because they found that the alums kept saying, we were able to speak for ourselves, and that's the thing that got us jobs. But he had this 4 years of taking courses in speech in some way. If you took oral interp one, there's an interp two.
Right.
And they did introduce the argumentation courses in that whole thing. But Benderson had, thanks to Phil, Phil got his buddies to come back, Carl Schmieder and me, and Walt from
Michigan State.
Yep. And later then they used me to talk Jack into coming back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we had the old gang.
And how about Hike the Monterosian?
Hike, God love him, he was here.
Yeah, he
was a stalwart
here.
And one of Emerson's finest products.
Mm-hmm.
Hike was, let me finish that other point though. We had a little bit of a revolt in the department because none of us felt it was fair advising kids to take more speech courses. And we also had, when I came back, we had the accreditation people breathing down our necks because we didn't have enough liberal arts. And I remember being on the library committee and they didn't have enough strength in liberal arts there.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only us, but BU as well. They said you can no longer cite, you know, the Boston Public Library as a great source for your students. You have to have your own. In our special areas, we were fine, but not in anything else. And so we had to do a lot of work there. So we used that as a thin entering wedge and trying to talk to Bender to pull this back because the students were really getting upset. What I liked was what we had, which was you had a two courses out of a set of five that you could run, and that was enough because at one point we had 300 majors in mm-hmm. our department mm-hmm. when I was chair.
Right.
And that was kind of scary because we had 60 grad students at the same time.
Right.
And I remember there were almost close to, I think we had 40 part-timers
mm-hmm.
Helping us out then
right.
at one point.
Right. A lot to govern. So Monterosian, you were very close with him, and we have a building, we actually have a room in the building that is dedicated thanks to all of your hard work. Well, what was it about Hike that was so magical to you? Because I know you light up when you talk about him.
Well, everybody loved Hike, I think. He was a stutterer, but not a strong stutterer. It was a mild stuttering, he started a business program, I think, at Bentley, and then he came to Emerson. And Fran worked with him, and Bender worked with him. Bender put him into debate. And what's interesting, and we had another guy, a student who was a much more severe stutterer. And when he debated, he lost that stuttering,
mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, the pressure was off of him socially,
right.
You know, one interpersonally, so he adopted. It's like stutterers can act, and that's what he was doing when he debated. Well, Hike overcame that pretty well, and really tried to become a strong orator, but he found. Through debate, argumentation, and he had a very analytical mind. He was just brilliant at times. If you wanted to, he was the kind of guy, think beyond the box,
mm-hmm.
he would, you know.
Yes.
And at one point, we had a lot of debaters coming in and out at that time, and like the Suffolk kids would come down and debate at Emerson, and then we'd go up there and, you know, refine our cases and so forth. So in 1958 or 59, there was resolved that the nuclear weapons should be banned, I don't remember the last phrase of it, but I think by international force or something like that. And so Hike wanted to try out different cases. So we had the Suffolk kids come down, and he wanted one case he tried out was, uh, he's, an abstract concept at the end, you know, preparing a final solution. And he said, it's got to be one world. He said, it can't be anything else. It has to be one world. And they started hammering away at that and so forth. The poor Suffolk kids had, but that was Hike.
Yes, threw the wrench in.
But Hike was devoted to the students he taught. Mm-hmm. He'd put them in a car and take them out to the prison to help with a debate program there or public speaking program. June Mitchell was the same way. We used to pile into her when I was, she said, you ought to get to know something about choral speech. So I was in the choral speech group.
Yes.
Well, they got engagements around town. So she had the small car, but we would put these platforms sticking out of her car. And another kid had a car, and so some of us got there by public transportation. We reassemble and do this. You know, Emerson was patchwork, it seemed, but at the same time, we were held together by this mutual ideology of growth through expression, and of course we had experienced it, mm-hmm. And that was the other thing. You know, you learn your expressive powers, and Emerson wanted to put out people in society who would do good, and he felt that through speaking and speaking good thoughts, and with a background of the best of literature and understanding of humanistic philosophy and so forth, that could be achieved. And so it was a noble ideal, and it worked for a lot of people. I'm sorry to go on about this.
No, this is very, very good in terms of history, because we have a lot of alums who are wanting to sort of remember those times, and they keep saying, why don't we have some oral histories? I don't know if the alumni office is doing this, but I think it's very important. Another person who, as you know, very instrumental to the department as well as to me, someone who, of course, is on the walls here in my office, is someone you knew for a long time. She saved the college, and that is Helen Rose.
Oh, God, love her.
Yeah, we have students who are going to be going various places because of her endowed scholarships, not to buildings. I remember she said when one administration was saying give to a building, she said, well, we've already done that, but we need to give to students. So can you tell us your perspectives on Helen, and then I'll quit quizzing you, because you've given us a lot. But Helen, I know you introduced me to Helen. She's the one, she and Cecil are the ones who talked about 21 Commonwealth being available, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They knew about that, and I was surprised. We were housed in 148.
Yes, sir, I remember that.
And Ken was in, I don't know, 306, in another building.
Yes, on Beacon Street.
Yeah, and I was surprised that they let us move because we always tended not to be in the foreground as a department, and we were a department that didn't demand a lot of heavy equipment like mass media did, or a lot of special kinds of needs like speech therapy. Speech therapy was big for about 10 years at Emerson, and then in the late 50s, early 60s, and that sort of thing. But we were just always there, you know, and she used us aid to speech therapy, which is what, you know. But she was, my first impression of Helen was at commencement. There was this woman who would start reading something with this resonant voice, you know, little thing. She'd get up there, and she was there, you know, at all of these graduations, and as her daughter said, she had hair that never moved.
That's true. Always immaculate. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh
huh. But I remember your helping doing the Helen Rose Room, a tribute to her many scholarships, etc. That was quite exciting.
Well. Again, we couldn't get much support from administration, so I bought some paint and we went in and painted the damn room.
Yes. I think Shepard and others, of course, Diego might have been a part of that painting job too.
He may have been. You were.
I know.
Because you helped to put some of the gold leaf in it. Gold leaf came out. There's an ersatz gold leaf that you can use now that's very nice.
Yes.
And we had a classic look to that room.
Right.
I was really glad to do something for her because it was like she found a home with us.
Yes.
In a sense, but mainly you were the center of that, and she saw that you were doing things that were really important, that involved a lot of students, and she supported that, and I think that gave her more of a philosophy of how she wanted to give to the college. She had given to the college for her aid to speech therapy, but before that, she and her husband had done the special work for the deaf, she got that law against the deaf to be rescinded, and that then they honored her a day. They had a Helen Rose Day, in Boston. So anyway, she saw that we were worth something,
yes.
Which I liked, and. Because we were always running for the theater people, running for the speech therapy people, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think what was exciting, and of course, when I look behind you, I see memories of her where she told us, in addition to doing the $650,000 gift to the college for the scholarship and the endowments for forensics, endowments for oral and TERP, endowments for the highest grade point average, she then would give us $10,000 a year for a conference. And as
it's
you
wonderful.
Know, yeah, if you look up here, we've got a quiz show, which of course was with the Clutters.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the JFK conference. We've got the mediated reality of JFK tragedy, the making of a media event. She took students, of course, to the Ritz for after the death of Princess Diana for conferences. I think she's truly.
That was in Paris.
Right, in Paris at the Ritz. Of course, we ate at Michelin restaurants. I kept
terrible.
Saying, amazing,
awful.
So generous. But Vito, what I would like to say is we are hoping that we're going to have yourself, and then I think I talked to you about Tom Dayhill.
Yes.
The Campbells, I guess, who were Emerson students, passed away, and their kids called and said, do you know anything about Tom Dayhill's paintings? And I said, well, you could talk to Tom Dayhill.
Yeah, so he's available.
What we'd like to do is to have something special for you and Tom and others during Alumni Weekend, where we recognize you and the importance contributions that you've made. It would just be something low-key where alums, because they come to me and they say, how are these people? And I said, well, we need to get you here. So I think if you're an alum, we're going to do that. If need be, we'll be on the 8th floor. Also, one of our favorite places is Fajitas and Rita's. I know some of the 80s alums want to be there, but tune in. We'll give you more details. But Dr. Vito Silvestri, had it not been for you, this alumni would have probably been stuck in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you so much, and thank you for being on Pain on Politics.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, thank you.
All right, tune in next, and we'll have another memory of Emerson College or a global leader. Who knows until you tune in. Pain on Politics from Emerson College.